call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. I apologize, committee, for being late. I just want to praise you all profusely for your punctuality. So today we have a public hearing. Oh, actually, we have an informational meeting to start off with, and that will take approximately 35 minutes. And I'll open the informational meeting, and Paul, tell us what we are informing ourselves on.
Okay. Madam Chair, you recall it was Senator Telfer who brought up the issue about delinquent accounts and liquidated delinquent accounts receivable, and I think you all should have a copy of the report, the annual report that comes out from the Legislative Fiscal Office. And the analysis in the report is done by the Comptroller's Division and the various agencies within state, including our Department of Revenue. So we've asked Comptroller's folks and Department of Revenue that actually put the numbers together to come and present to you and answer any questions that you may have about where those numbers come from and how they're calculated and what they mean.
Okay. Come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and the committee, my name is John Dufresne. I'm the statewide financial services manager at the State Controller's Office, Department of Administrative Services.
Chair Burdick, member of the committee, is Larry Warren with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm the withholding program manager.
As Mr. Warner indicated, we work with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and in fact, we started with the Legislative Fiscal Office in developing this report back about 1999-2000. And so we have historical data all the way back to that if you want to see some types of comparisons. And part of the information in the handout, I hope you have the PowerPoint document, goes through and does comparative analysis, shows where there's been collections. We do the kinds of inventory analysis and such that have been basically requested in the past. So we just kind of put this together in hopes to go through and answer any questions you might have. So would you like me to just proceed through this document?
Please do. Thank you.
Okay. Collection history, I believe, was one of the questions. How is the state doing in their collections? As I indicated, we track the collections using the Legislative Fiscal Office data, which is collected annually. State agencies have to supply that data as of a June 30th cutoff date. It's supplied by October 1st. Legislative Fiscal accumulates that information into the report, which has been presented to the legislature. And we take that information and do, as Mr. Warner indicated, do some statistical analysis, and we create a strategic plan, which is available on our website, and we can send you links or send you copies of the document if you like, where we talk about what the data is saying to us, what areas we maybe need to focus on to make improvements, and where we can get, if you will, the most bang for our buck in collections. One of the other things we do talk about in here is what environmental factors may be influencing our ability to collect. So, for instance, the economy, and we have a graphic in here, I think, that shows it very well, what we can expect to see from the economy and what kinds of adverse reflections we may see in our collections data from that. As far as cumulative collections, and I'm on slide 3, we show that since the inception of this program, we've collected $2.1 billion. And that's what state agencies, just the state agencies, have collected. The other agency accounts unit at the Department of Revenue has collected $179 million, and the private collection firms that we've used have brought in $87 million. And I'll just flip through these. If you have any questions, please feel free. If we look on annual collections by year, again, there you can kind of see how the collections are broken out, again, by what state agencies collect, other agency account unit collects, and what the private collection firms collect. And as you can see, the results in the 2001-2002 recession, how we see that dampening of the collections effectiveness. The next slide, slide 5, talks about collection rates. And again, we just provide the rate of collections. For this particular instance, we actually brought in the Department of Revenue's collection statistics and posted those in there along with, again, all state agencies accumulated, other agencies account unit, and the private collection firms. One of the questions, are we still using private collection firms? And the answer is yes. And again, our data shows how their collection is. Most recent numbers show that they have an inventory. I'm just going to flip to the next page, page 7. Their inventory of accounts as of 2008 was $470 million. So if we were to look at the accounts, $1.1 billion is in the hands of state agencies, $470 million is in the hands of private collection firms, and $208 million is in the hands of the or other agency account units at the Department of Revenue. And remember, this is a circulation process. The state agency brings in the receivables, and remember, the receivables are usually collected right up front. What we're talking about when we talk about liquid and delinquent accounts are the ones that are much more difficult to collect, that may have to go through an adjudication process or some type of a judicial process to validate that, yes, this is what is owed by the person. So the state agency takes that first collection practices, then they turn that over to the other agency account unit, and the other agency account unit, the Department of Revenue, tries to collect for anywhere from 3 to 12 months, it all depends. And then after that collection process, it goes to the private collection firms, and they collect anywhere from 12 to 24 months on those accounts. And when the Oregonian called me a couple years ago, they said, well, that sounds like a pretty thorough process. And I said, yes, by the end of that process, we pretty well squozing all the blood out of the turnip. They like that quote. the next slide, slide number 8, is liquidated delinquent debt by agency. And so as you go through and look, judicial has roughly 40% of the debt, revenue 27.1%, justice, and that's largely the child support debt at 19.1%, and so on. So roughly 86% of the state's debt resides in those first three agencies. One of the other questions we often receive is, do we use credit bureaus? So on slide 9, we talk about we do in some circumstances, and largely if any of our debt is recorded with the county courthouse, whether you record warrants, whether you get judgments, any of those types of things, that debt is picked up usually by third parties and returned over to credit bureau reporting. As part of our statewide collection contract with private collection firms, we have a condition in there that is a flag, if you will, that says please report this debt to these credit bureaus as well. And that will depend on the state agency's concern about, you know, how that information might be used and how much they want it shared with other entities. Again, that slide 10 shows that roughly 78% of the debt is reported to credit bureaus. And when we, by breakout, some is reported. And again, we're kind of trying to show, you know, in what big amounts. The next slide, as I mentioned, we're looking at statistics and trying to say, you know, how do we maintain expectations and make sure everyone's doing a good job. This is a graph showing our collections over the last 9 years, and then a graph of the unemployment. And you can see there's pretty much a direct inverse relationship. As the unemployment numbers go out, our collection rates are going to go down. One of the real positives in the 2008, as you see the dotted line, that's where we would have ended up, but by offsets through the Department of Revenue, the kicker check gave us about $43 million. So it made us a little healthier than we would have been without that opportunity. I'll turn it over to Larry to talk about the Department of Revenues.
Before you do, how does that work? How does that hydraulic with the kicker work on that graph?
The Department of Revenue has an offset program that they can use internally, and it's also available for the other agency accounts unit. And so when they get ready to issue refunds, and that would be refund checks or kicker checks, there's a check. And anybody who's turned in their debt to those agencies to check to see if they are on that list, those dollars are then sent over to that agency to pay that debt, and what remaining funds go out to the taxpayer.
Got it. Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just pick up where John left off. The Department of Revenue in 2003 added a Treasury offset program, and we projected that we would generate $3 million from that program. And in the first year, we were able to generate $5.2 million. That program still is in existence today, and we still utilize it as a collection tool. In addition, in 2003, the Department had three revenue enhancement policy option packages, and we projected that those would generate $20 million. And the actual generation turned out to be $22 million. In 2005, we added an additional policy option package where we projected $17 million of revenue, and the actuals turned out to be $21 million. And in addition, in the 2005, we added a policy option package that had other agency account staff, and we were projecting $18 million of revenue from that, and saw our actuals of $22.6 million. One thing we like to point out, these POPs continue to generate revenue even today because the staff are still out there collecting and working. And in 2007, the department did not request any additional policy option packages to add collection staff. The next slide, and I apologize, it's a little small for viewing, but that's just a snapshot. The numbers in the LFO report were of June 2008, and we thought it would be a benefit to show where we're at as of February 2009. And you can see we're going through our normal cycle, whereas the end of June 2008, we had 99,157 accounts, and as of February 2009, we had 159,119 accounts, and then the dollar values there also. We would expect to see that as we go through our filing seasons and the debts go through liquid and delinquent stages. We see an upsurge and a down throughout the year. We thought it would also be good to show on the next slide the personal income tax at private collections. And just like we've seen the amount of accounts that the Department of Revenue has that we're actively collecting go up, we've seen an increase also in the amount that we have at private collections. And again, we would expect to see that as we go through our normal filing and collection cycles. And then just a note on where revenue is heading in the future. We do have a policy option package in the 2009-11 governor's recommended budget to add collection and filing enforcement staff. And that one is projected to generate $19.3 million. And then the result of that package was actually, in the last 3 years, the collection function has worked together as a team and conducted an exhaustive review of our collection practices, which was the result of the policy option package. And along the way, we found some other changes that we can make without additional revenue, and many of those changes have already been made. And part of that process we've looked at is how we utilize the private collection firms and making sure we're using their expertise to the best of their abilities to help us collect the accounts receivable. So,
Okay. On these, is that the conclusion? On these policy option packages, to go back to page 4, where you talk about the Treasury Offset Program, and then 3, Revenue Enhancement Policy Option Packages, I'll get this straight, where you expected $20 million and you actually got $22 million. Is that after you subtract the cost of the new people, or if not, what was the cost of the new people?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would say that's how we normally do that, so I'm going to suspect that's what was done here, but it may not have been. It may have just been total revenue generation, not less the cost. I know for this one that we've asked for and the governor's recommended this year, for instance, it's $19.3 million of revenue generation at a cost of around $6 million.
Okay, could you get that data for us on all these where you talk about the policy option packages, because for both the past and in the governor's budget for 9/11, because we're going to be considering as a committee whether to, you know, as we study the compliance issue, what recommendations, if any, to make to Ways and Means to try to get better collection.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'll get that data to you just as soon as we can.
Thank you. And then has anyone studied whether there's a point of kind of diminishing return on your investment if you get more collectors?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a question that we ask ourselves frequently. And one of the differences in the policy option package that we'll be asking for this time is to add a level of our collectors that we don't have now, a Revenue Agent 2. We collect with Revenue Agent 1s and Revenue Agent 3s currently. And some of that was we were seeing that the lower level accounts that the Revenue Agent 1s can work, we haven't reached saturation on those, but we've reached an optimal level with that. So if we go forward with our Revenue Agent 2s, they can collect some of the more difficult accounts, and that's why we've package the policy the way that we have, but yeah, we don't have a finite. This number of revenue agents is the optimal amount that we're shooting for.
Okay, Senator Hess.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is very, very important for this next biennium to have this buttoned down, because there's these sort of cascading and inverse graphs where, you know, as the economy tightens up, the number of delinquent accounts obviously increases. There's pressure to cut staff at all of the agencies, and, you know, making the situation worse. And it's really important, as you know, I think for us to sort of in some ways become ambassadors to do this to Ways and Means members, and but it's really good to arm ourselves with the best data possible to say here's what's going to happen if you cut these people, here's what's going to happen if you add more or add 10 or add 5 or whatever it is, and there is that dynamic that occurs when the economy goes down.
Senator Telfer, it's time for your quote. Let's have your quote because it's perfect.
Well, I could ask a question of, what does it take to get something, written off, so I could help my clients like go this far. But my question is similar in that, what's your debt write off rate, your reserve ratio? Well, how many of these debts are actually going to get written off, or what's your percentage?
Senator Telfer, members of the committee, I don't have that information, but I can get it to you. We actually, in the last biennium, have added, we have two things we can do now. We can actually write off the debt, which allows it to go to a hold where we can't be actively collecting on that debt. But if we see something like wages come up, we can pull it back into active collections and begin collecting on it again. And then we have what we call cancellation, which is where we cancel it and it's off the books for good. We'll never go back to cancel it. So I can get those numbers to the committee.
Follow-up? And it would be probably helpful to advise the committee as to what's your statute on collection, meaning how long can you go after somebody?
Senator Burdick and Senator Telfer, I actually brought some write-off. I don't have it in a way I can give it to you, but I would be happy to send it to you. I think, and to kind of piggyback on what Larry said, the act of write-off is an accounting event, not a liability event. So in other words, the statute of limitations for state debt is infinite. There is no statute of limitations. So when we say we're writing off a debt, the agency should be making the decision that this, because of whatever circumstances, and actually the Secretary of State provides guidance in this area as to what types of circumstances constitute a good reason to write off the debt. The agency has to have a policy for handling debts less than $5,000 internally, and any debt over $5,000 has to be submitted to the Secretary of State for write-off. I want to see either the 2005 or 2007 session. I can give you a copy of that. I'll make a note here. The Secretary of State did a analysis of write-offs, and that was a pretty well-done analysis. And the only point that was really made clear was that perhaps universities were writing off student loans too quickly. But we'll get you a copy of that information. Over the last 9 years, our write-offs have actually done kind of a cliff and valley decline from about, I have to take my glasses off, I apologize to see, from about 4.2% down to about, it looks like 2.5%. I will expect that to now start going back up over the next 2 or 3 years as the system goes through. If you recall, when we talked about how the debt is processed, there's a year or so at the agency, a year or so at the other agency account unit, and 2 years at private collections. So it's 4 to 5 years, assuming nothing happens to that debt, to get through the system. So, again, the Secretary of State has some good write-off guidelines, and we ask that agencies use those. We have those incorporated in the Oregon Accounting Manual, so it's easy for them to see those. And the only other piece of that is to follow up on the cancellation. And, again, that is a cancellation of the liability. So once those are canceled, those are removed from the books. Those are removed as liabilities and are longer collectible. So we usually suggest strongly that you use your write-off capabilities first, because if you later determine, as the story I like to use, is that you just wrote off Joe Smith, and gosh, who won the lottery? Joe Smith. So you have the ability to go get Joe Smith and get that money from you.
What are the ways, besides winning the lottery, would you have a chance to understand about Joe Smith's changing circumstances?
Depending on the sophistication of the agency and the use of private collection firms and other agency account units, there's a number of tools that agencies use. We're working with the DAS contracting office right now for skip tracing tools that gives you some more information about, if you can find them. Sometimes that obviously improves your ability to collect. So one of the things is to locate them, track them down. There's kind of a, I'll call it a 7-year rule. And That has to do with folks that have gone through a period of bad times and maybe have gone through bankruptcy. And after 7 years, assuming the right demographics, there's a good chance that person is back making money. And in many cases, I've been told by collectors that these people actually recontact and say, hey, you know, I stiffed you for $2,000. I want to pay that off. I want to make it right. In other cases, they're discovered through other ways. So, again, that's another reason we really push agencies to think of it as a write-off and then go back in 5 to 7 years and see, you know, what is the probability of collections for these types of accounts. So, In many respects, the agencies have a good feel for their demographics and their debtors, and they have a good feel for what their timing should be. And we rely, you know, largely on the agencies to think about that.
Tell me again what the alternative to the write-off is.
If you don't write off, then it's a cancellation.
And once you cancel it, you can't go back?
Correct. Yeah, that's a cancellation of the liability.
And that, does the person who owes the money, when you cancel it, they get informed so they know they're canceled?
Not necessarily. It would depend on how that cancellation was about. It may go through, you know, there's settlement agreements. There's a number of ways that the issue could be raised and that the parties could come to some type of resolution. It could go through bankruptcy, and then you'd have to determine if that debt is one of the debts that would be expunged through bankruptcy. Department of Revenue's debts wouldn't be, but you'd have to go through and just kind of see what the circumstances is. That would be a case for the collections and maybe in the Attorney General's office to do some type of analysis on a per-case basis.
So if they can do the write-off, why would they do the cancellation? Why do they use it, and how often do they use it?
That would require some research. Again, over the last 5 years, we have attempted to push everyone into the write-off as a better choice.
Would you like a bill to prohibit cancellation? What would happen if that were to be done?
I don't know. Again, that would be some type of AG discussion or something that you would want to see. Is there conditions where you wouldn't want to go down, you know, that you'd want to cancel and get out of it?
Mm-hmm. Senator Telford.
Thank you. There might be some legal reasons you cancel it, mm-hmm. such as certain bankruptcies. There would be a reason you cancel it, particularly estates, death, things like to that.
Correct.
I know.
Senator Burdick, Senator Telford, there's another one that just came into my mind, too, is some of the old, if we remember the old leaky underground storage tank properties, the lust tax properties. In some cases, the counties were really in a difficult bind in their collection process because they would have to foreclose on the property and expose themselves to millions of dollars in cleanups upon taking possession. So there were some cases there where, you know, again, a legal case where you may not want to pursue collections but may not be appropriate to cancel either. So difficult area.
Okay. Maybe it's worth a little more discussion on whether it needs some sideboards around it. Any other questions from the committee?
I do, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. You have referenced the difference in collection rates between private and the state. And I'm wondering, what is the average age of those receivables that are assigned to the private collection firms? And what's the average age to the state agencies?
Senator Burdick, Senator Morris, I don't have that information with me, but you can be pretty certain that the average liquid and delinquent debt that a state agency's collection has just gone through an accounts receivable process, has just gone through some type of liquidation process, again, which is perhaps an adjudication or some type of final order, and they would then have the next opportunity for the next 12 months, assuming no collection action occurred. If they have any type of collection action, they can get the person on a payment schedule. That could go on for, we recommend no more than 2 years to do paybacks on those types of things. So in that scenario, it could be two years before they would then say, oh, okay, we're not getting any more money. We turn it over, use the other agency account units, and use private collections. So it is kind of a sieve process, and as you go through that sieve process, it becomes more and more difficult to collect, a matter of time. Another issue, though, is if they're out of state, some agencies immediately send them to private collections for out-of-state collections because other agency account unit really doesn't have, you know, they're an in-state collection source, not necessarily out-of-state collection source. So I am talking kind of in generalities. I don't have any specific numbers.
So the point of my question was that if you're assigning those most difficult and most seasoned and the longest average collection to the privates, it may not be an accurate statement to say that, as the following statistics show, state agencies continue to be the state's best collectors. So it has to be factored. If you're assigning the accounts that are really difficult, you're going to have a much more difficult time. And if the privates are picking those up, and if you're looking at it on merit, where you're at, the state is at 20, almost, I can't read that print, almost 25%, and privates are below?
About 2.5%.
2.5%. There's got to be more to the story.
I'm sorry, sir, was there a question?
Well, I think you've answered the question in that you assign, as I understand it, you assign the most difficult accounts to collect to the privates.
Correct. As they go through the process, they become, if you will, the most difficult, and they would be assigned to the private collection firms at that point.
Yeah.
So would it be fair to say that if you didn't bring the private firms in on that you might have to write those off?
It would certainly increase the likelihood of write-off if, again, the account meaning all other characteristics of a write-off.
Okay. Other questions? Just Senator Telford.
One final, and it's because you don't have an offer and compromise process like the IRS, because you don't, your write-offs are unlimited in collection. But it becomes important to collect that which is owed you and not spend a lot of money collecting it. Is there anything else that you think would expedite collection other than adding more personnel? Are there any processes or anything that you can see that if you were king of the collection, that you could, you know, wave your magic wand and say, if only we had this or were able to do this, we could collect faster?
Senator Burdick and Senator Telford, you raise an interesting question with the settlements. I was an advocate for settlements a few years back. I think it does offer you the opportunity to bring those dollars in faster. Obviously, if there's money available and you can see it that way, then, you know, certainly that's a benefit. Or if there's assets that you know are securable, it can place you, for instance, in a better stead against the IRS, who may be making a settlement as well, and so now you get the money. I am aware. I spent 15 years at the Department of Revenue, so I know that in some cases the IRS beat us to the funds. Mm-hmm. So those are the positives. On the negative side, you get into the question of fairness. You get into the question of there's a philosophy that you're wasting public assets. And so there would be some kind of question about, you know, how would you write that in such a way that you could indemnify the manager making that decision, saying, well, this was made on the best information available, and then tomorrow you find out that they have additional funds and you've made the settlement and it's a done deal, unless, of course, there's fraud. So I would certainly say it's worth a look, you know, taking a committee to take a look at that and making sure that you fully understand the pros and cons of something like that.
Madam Chair, point of clarification. I was not a proponent of settlement.
Oh, okay.
I was asking, is there any mm-hmm. procedure or anything that you could suggest to us that would enhance your ability to collect faster, expedite the whole collection for you?
Madam Chair, Senator Telford, members of the committee, one of the other components of the policy option package that we've put together this year is a web self-sufficiency portion, and I believe that would be right now the thing that the Department of Revenue collections could benefit from the most, is having a website out there where folks can resolve their accounts 24 hours a day in a fashion similar to they would with any other financial institution that they're working with.
And what would the fiscal on that be?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've asked for $250,000 of funding in our policy option package for that.
Are there other states that do that, that you can model what kind of returns you get?
Washington has always been a leader in that, our members to the north, and we've talked with them quite a bit. Kansas is always seen as a good leader in that, and actually Georgia has a really good website. So okay. We've been talking with them as we put the information together.
Senator Hess.
On the issue of amnesty, which has been experimented with other states, I think Oregon has a rather checkered past with this, and I remember this used to come up when I was in the House.
It's about to become even more checkered, Senator Hess.
Is there any new thought on that? Has it evolved in any way in the last few years? Is it better to not do it in downtime, or is it, if you're ever going to do it, this is the time to do it? Is there a strategy there if you ever go that route?
Senator Hass, member of the committees, I would defer that question probably to Elizabeth Harchank, our director.
Give her the Teflon.
She'll have a chance to testify because we do have a bill up next week on amnesty. So. Did you want to ask anything else? For them? Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
I'm going to go call Greg Smith.
Okay. We will take a 5-minute recess. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Jason.
Yeah.
We will reconvene the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, just perfect timing here. And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 690. Chris, you want to go over the bill, and then we'll talk to Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 690 is largely an outgrowth of the compliance report that the Department of Revenue put together over the interim, and it provides the Department of Revenue with several additional tools to enhance tax compliance, and as well as some data match programs between the department and financial institutions. And then there's also a piece, I believe, from Representative Smith, that deals with reporting information to consumer reporting agencies. The theme there is providing a number of tools to enhance tax compliance and tax collections.
Great. Come on up, Representative Smith, and speak your piece.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57 from Northeastern Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. First of all, I want to share with this committee what you already know, and that is you have a wonderful, wonderful staff member in Mr. Warner. He has been an excellent resource as I've tried to pursue a concept that I'm about to share with you, and that is the reporting of delinquent accounts to consumer reporting agencies, the three big credit reporting agencies. I want to share with you a little bit of my background, my professional background. I manage a limited liability company that specializes in business and industrial financing. I work with multiple lenders, traditionally commercial banks, in the financing of small business. And quite often, I run credit reports, trying to determine the credit capacity of small business owners as they look at capital construction projects. And one of the observations I had is that quite often, money that is owed to the state of Oregon is not listed on a credit report. And that never made sense to me. And this concept I tried to raise back in 2001, but with a Republican-controlled House, I could get nowhere, and I let that idea die. Now we're in a situation where money is of utmost importance to this body. We're trying to turn over every rock, and this is one of those rocks that we can turn over. What Section 9 of Senate Bill 690 does is it would allow the Oregon Department of Revenue to report to consumer reporting agencies delinquent accounts owed to the state of Oregon. I want to share with you several benefits of that, if I may, just very quickly. Quite often, what has at least been shared with me as a member of the Ways and Means Committee, is that people will owe money to the state of Oregon, they will flee the state of Oregon, and it becomes very difficult then for the Oregon Department of Revenue to collect that money. And quite often those accounts then are either turned over to a collection agency, or the state of Oregon just continues to book them as an aging account. Nonetheless, that money goes uncollected. What I would share with you is that by reporting it to a consumer reporting agency, when citizens go to apply for credit, whether it's a car loan or a home loan or a business line of credit, that lender is going to pull a credit report. And if the state of Oregon is reporting that consumers are owing money to the state, the very first thing that lender is going to do is step back and talk with the potential borrower and say, you need to get this cleaned up. Go take care of this issue with the state of Oregon and then return back to us to follow through on your application. And that's going to be the case whether the person lives in Washington or New Hampshire or Florida. And so I don't know what the revenue impact will be to the state of Oregon, but I can assure you that our collection activities will be significantly enhanced by those citizens who have chosen to ignore their owings to the state of Oregon, but are in the process of trying to acquire credit elsewhere. We've had a work group on this where we sat down with the credit union folks and with the banker folks, along with the mortgage lenders as well. And we shared this concept with them, and we did not receive any opposition. As a matter of fact, the light bulb kind of turned on with each of them, and they thought that this would be a tool for them to use. The last fact I want to share with you is that I think this is going to be a tool that will help lenders actually enhance their credit decision-making ability, which, as you know, in this environment is very important because there's been a lot of bad loans. And I'll just share a very personal experience, but I'll leave the names out. As I shared with you, that I loan money out to small business and industry. Well, part of that responsibility is also following up with credits. And quite often, we'll do just background checks once a year, 2 years, just to see how the small business owner is doing. Well, on one business owner, just randomly, I ran a credit check on them and found out that they owed the federal and the state government about $260,000 in delinquent payroll taxes. Well, this was new to me. I didn't know this. Let me digress. I said I ran a credit report. That's not accurate. What I did is I called the Oregon Department of Revenue and found out they owed the money. I didn't see it on the credit report. Consequently, I was able to step in and help that small business owner work through the issue, take care of their payroll tax. The state of Oregon was able to receive some money. The small business owner was able to get the issue taken care of, and a positive situation occurred. Anyway, I'm here to support Section 9 of Senate Bill 690. It's a tool that's going to help the state of Oregon in its collection efforts. It's a tool that's going to help the finance industry of Oregon make better credit decisions. And I think it's a tool that's going to help small business owners and consumers in the management of their credit. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, or Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are you aware of other states? I mean, does the federal government report to credit reporting agencies?
Yes, Chair Burdick. When I pull a credit report, whether it's from TransUnion or Equifax, quite often I will see the Oregon or the Internal Revenue Service and an owing, but I never see the Oregon Department of Revenue.
And do you have any idea of if we add this, what impact it would have on the actual FICO score? If someone had that entry in there, I mean, is this going to be something that will knock it down sharply or just a little bit?
You know, it's going to depend, Madam Chair, on their overall credit and their other credit activities. What I would surmise is that, yes, it would have a negative impact on their credit, but at the same time, once that issue is resolved with the state of Oregon, that would result in an enhanced credit score.
Senator Telford, did you have a question?
Just a comment on the reason the IRS shows up is because the IRS files liens.
That is correct.
And that's why they're showing up.
Okay.
Because you have a major problem with people who are appealing or in tax court with outstanding liabilities being reported when that hasn't been resolved. And the IRS only gets shown up on somebody's credit when numerous processes have been dealt with, and they finally file a lien. So
that is correct.
That's something Oregon might want to look at too, okay. Securing that debt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Actually, that is something. Would you be open to suggesting or to considering something like that as a method of getting on to the
very much so, Chair Burdick.
Court.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, I guess. When you talked about when a lender does discover something like this on the credit report, that they say, wait a minute, you got to resolve this. Is that what actually happens, that they will say you can't have the money unless you resolve this?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. And quite often it's to the consumer's benefit. Quite often consumers will not necessarily exercise fiduciary prudence, and they will try and borrow more than they're capable of. And quite often they'll borrow when they have outstanding obligations they should be taking care of. By requiring a consumer to step back and to meet its obligation, to take care of its obligation before receiving more debt is a prudent way to act. And using the words of Senator Johnson when I visited with this issue with her, she said, I don't know why Sears should take precedence over the state of Oregon. Sears reports, the state of Oregon doesn't. This is an opportunity to change that.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the committee? Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for bringing us this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, let's get Elizabeth Harchenko and Deborah Buchanan up to go into a little more detail on the underlying report here and on the bill. Committee, we have the 2009 report on personal income tax compliance, which I think you're going to start off on that, and then Ms. Buchanan will talk about the bill.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I think what I'd like to do is just very briefly remind you of the tax compliance report that I delivered to, was actually to House Committee January 30, at which many of you were able to join. And just sort of the highlights from that that study, you've got it, you have the ability to look through it in more detail, but we tried to develop a list of best practices from our peers around the country and from the IRS, as well as from a consultant that we happened to have doing some other work for us at the time, to look at collection practices and to look at the kinds of things that we could do to answer Senator Telfer's question, which is, what are the tools that we don't have today that if we did could help make a difference, helping taxpayers resolve their obligations more quickly with us? And the primary areas where we found that others were having good experience were additional third-party reporting and verification of items of income or deductions or other matters that are related to liability, simplification of the tax code. We need to work on optimizing the way we select audit cases, sharing more information strategically and carefully with partners, business partners, whether it's other state agencies or the service or some in the private sector, to allow us to improve compliance. And we recommended some policy changes that we would need statutory authority to implement, and those are in Senate Bill 690, along with a couple of other things that have been discussed along the way. Primarily what we recommended was that you expand our authority to disclose information about whether taxpayers are in compliance with the income tax laws to licensing boards, particularly to the Board of Tax Practitioners and the Board of Accountancy, to a broader range of law enforcement agencies, and to use a matching system with the banking industry to identify assets when we're trying to collect. So those recommendations are contained in Senate Bill 690, along with some other things. If I could take just a couple of minutes, there were a couple questions that came up when John Dufresne and Larry Warren were here talking to you previously that I did have the answer to, and rather than send them off to research something, the data that Larry gave you about the policy option packages we had in the past, those dollars were net new revenue after cost of the package. So we had already deducted the payroll expense and services and supplies costs before reporting that net amount of revenue, so that those dollars were net.
And would that be the same for your projection of the governor's budget POP that you have now?
In the governor's recommended budget, we have to include both pieces. Here's what it's going to cost, and here's the gross amount of additional revenue. I think the net is somewhere around $12 million, okay. Or a little more than $12 million.
Okay, thank you.
The other thing I wanted to make sure that you were aware of as we talk about collection and particularly the use of private collection agencies is that just because of, as John Dufresne mentioned, the sort of chunking down of that debt, the process we go through is if we have a taxpayer, for example, who files a tax return indicates a certain amount of liability but doesn't make the payment, we can begin collection on that almost immediately, and quite a bit of that receivable comes in within 90 days or so. And that's the easiest to collect. It's something we've automated and we can pursue very easily. Under legislation that's been enacted by the legislature over the last several sessions, we do have the requirement that if agencies aren't able to or don't have contact with debtors for a 12-month period, we are required to move that debt out so that it can be worked by private collectors. They do not have some of the tools that we do for collection, and I think a portion of the difference in their ability to collect, in addition to just the age of the accounts and whether we've been able to find someone, is that we have the ability to issue an administrative garnishment without having to go through a long court process, and that ability also enhances our ability to collect. So there's a tool mix difference as well as a aging of accounts that can affect their ability to perform for us. And then I think that when we talk about what's in the legislation, the tools that not only what we have asked for, but the two additional tools that have been worked into the legislation, almost everything now that we have or that we've suggested that you consider are things that are in sort of the ideal toolkit as we've heard from our peers around the country.
Okay, so. Thank you. Just while you're there, and Deborah might be getting into this later, but on the point that Senator Telfer brought up, that the IRS can put things in the credit reporting agencies because they're attached to a lien, do you have an opinion on whether we should just report them to the credit agency, or do you think the Oregon Department of Revenue should also do it through the lien process?
Well, Madam Chair, there are two things that we do today that do result in tax debt showing up in the credit reporting system. If we have gotten to the point in the steps that we go through to try to resolve debt with a taxpayer, where we're always going to begin with, is there a way we can work with the taxpayer and voluntarily they will either make a payment or step into a payment arrangement with us? We don't have to take any steps that involve public disclosure of that obligation in order for the taxpayer to satisfy the obligation. So our practice has been to work with the taxpayers, and some of the agents say that if a taxpayer understands that if they work with us, something isn't going to show up in their credit report or there won't be a lien on their property, it's a motivating factor for them to work with us and resolve their obligation. If we're not able to get cooperation, then before we can garnish wages or attach property, we are required to record publicly our administrative, they're called distraint warrants under the statute. Mm-hmm. And upon the recording of those, they do get picked up and captured then by the credit reporting agency. So it's the way that our process works. A certain portion of our liabilities don't get to that place because the taxpayer is working with us. It's when they don't, and we have to go to the more involuntary types of tools that we end up then going into the public system. We have to pay recording fees in order to record those warrants. And so we're thoughtful about using our budget resources to pay recording fees if we don't feel that we're going to need to in order to secure payment. That said, the other concern that we always have is there's clear direction from the legislature in the statute that tax information and taxpayer information, we should keep that confidential as much as we can. And so we're not going to be disclosing information without being sure that we have clear authority to do so. We do have a statute currently that allows us to disclose information for purposes of collection, and clearly in order to record a warrant and follow through with a garnishment of wages or some other type of securing of our our debt against assets is going to involve public or some publication or sharing of information outside the agency. And so what the bill will do is clearly state the legislative policy that it's okay for us to share information about an obligation with a credit reporting agency at any time in the collection process. So it gives us that clear authority from you that that is an exception to the general rule of keeping taxpayer information confidential.
So what you would do is you'd use this as a tool in certain cases, like even if you weren't going to do a lien, you would use this as a tool to maybe nudge somebody into cooperating.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't have the language of the bill memorized. I'm not sure whether it's a directive or an authorization. If it's an authorization, then we could establish criteria for when we would report it. If it's a direction, then as long as the case fits the situation in the bill, then we would be required to report the information. So that's another one of the sort of policy issues that I hope that you'll discuss among yourselves, is do you want to direct us to use this in all cases, or do you want to authorize us to use it as a tool as we see it benefits our ability to collect?
And the way the bill is now, it's a directive. All right, questions from the committee? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question I would have is it really a debt? I mean, are people failing to comply when the agency is trying to use its usual methods because they somehow know that credit bureaus aren't getting this information? That doesn't seem like the first thing people are thinking about when they owe back taxes is, oh, I won't pay these taxes because it's really not going to hurt my credit rating. I mean, I would assume, especially in this economy, people realize they're in some legal jeopardy by not paying their taxes as well as whatever other debts they owe. So I guess what I'm really asking is, do you think it would increase compliance if we were, as a routine matter, sharing this information beyond what we're already doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I don't think that any single tool that you might give us is a silver bullet. All of them, though, are useful tools. And I do know that we've heard from other states that this is a tool that has an effect on some. I don't know that people, as they go through the thought in their mind about why they aren't paying their taxes, go through that analytical process of, well, let's see, will it hurt my credit rating? You know, it's more, as we talked about in the report, some people don't comply because they don't realize they're not complying because it's a complex system and they don't understand it. Some people don't comply because they are, especially if they're just not paying, they may be reporting accurately and just not coming up with the dollars to make the payment. It's probably more likely, I don't think I can afford to pay this, rather than I'm going to get away with not having it on my credit report. And then others, the big majority, are people who are filing reports and saying, I owe this much, when in fact they owe some other amount, and we have to discover that. So if you remember the conversation we had at the end of January. The tool here is one that is usable really only after we've identified someone and we know how much they owe, and they know that they owe that much, and we aren't in dispute about how much it is. It's really a matter of how do we now create a situation in which they have a high degree of motivation to resolve that obligation and pay for it. And this is one tool. And I think that what Representative Smith pointed out, which is a benefit that really is helpful, is that because the databases of the credit reporting agencies are national, if we have someone who used to work in Oregon or did owe Oregon tax at one point in time and they have moved and we aren't able to locate them, they might pop up somewhere else. And if they are seeking credit, a lender will say, did you know that? and we may not have any idea where they are. And so there's an additional set of eyes that are out there now watching for that obligation and that can urge that person to resolve it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
Well, not to be famous, but in your report, it does say that one of the findings is
the compliance would increase if the department were perceived to be more aggressive. And I think to the extent that, you know, there's awareness that this change may come about, that that in itself would raise compliance.
Just when we talk about compliance, are we talking about compliance with filing and filing a correct and accurate return versus complying with paying the tax? I mean, to me, those are two different things. But as we talk about compliance here, are we talking about both those things?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, when we use the phrase compliance, we're talking about all of those things.
Okay.
We're talking about payment, timely payment, filing timely and correctly, reporting the correct amount of tax, and paying the correct amount of tax when due. And so it's that whole spectrum that we're looking to try to optimize.
Well, follow-up question.
Please, then. Well, you said pay the tax when due, April 15th. Somebody can't pay it. Subsequent to that, then they start dealing with collections. Is that still compliance in our definition of talking about compliance issues right here?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, would you just like to go through the bill section by section? Is that your preference?
However you want to do it.
Very good.
We will place ourselves in your good hands.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Section 1 of the bill is implementing the bulleted item related to disclosure to local law enforcement. So that's the fourth bulleted item. I'm on page 19 of the tax compliance report, the recommendations for the 2009 session.
Oh, okay. So
okay, we're on the bill.
You just mentioned and section 1 of the bill. Okay.
So Madam Chairman, I was thinking that I would compare what's in the bill to the recommendations in the report.
Perfect. Okay.
So section 1 would authorize us to disclose information to local law enforcement agencies, which was one of the recommendations.
And that's on page 19?
Of the report.
Right there. Okay, it's right at the bottom left of the page, committee. Allow disclosure to local law enforcement. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 2 of the bill, on page 2, line 22 and line 23, is deleting language that requires the department to use all other methods of collection before it can start license suspension proceedings. So we would recommend deleting that restriction. That would allow us to start those proceedings earlier in the collection process. And Madam Chair, we have identified some amendments that we would recommend. If you'd like me to just touch on those as I go through, I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, just briefly while we're talking about it. But where is this, the licensing item in the report?
In the report, that is the first bulleted item. Expand disclosure authority to Oregon licensing boards and ask for a license suspension earlier in the filing enforcement process.
Still on page 19.
Yes. And in that bulleted item, you'll notice that it mentions either non-filing or non-payment. And this is where I would talk about our first recommended amendment to the bill. We've been advised by our attorneys that the current language requires that there actually be a tax assessed before we start license suspension proceedings. And we would suggest that you consider whether failure to file a return also could allow us to start that license suspension procedure. So on line 9 and 10 and lines 21 and 22 of the bill, page 2, we would have some language there that would provide that if it's either failure to file a return or failure to pay the tax, that the provisions in the statute could apply. Also, in that same language, you'll notice that it requires or it provides that a petition before the department has not been filed. That's on lines 10, 11, and line 22. And our attorneys advised that we don't receive those petitions anymore since the implementation of the Magistrate Division of the Oregon Tax Court. This language is not no longer relevant, so we have suggested changes for that as well.
Okay. That would just be a housekeeping amendment.
Yes.
Okay.
Section 3 of the bill, pages 3, 4, 5, have no language changes. page 6, lines 14 through 17, are adding to the current disclosure authority, disclosure to financial institutions and consumer reporting agencies, as described later in the bill. Mm-hmm. So this is authorizing us to disclose information. Section 4 on page 6 deals with the disclosure to the Oregon Board of Accountancy. That's the second bulleted item in the report. So that expands disclosure ability to the Oregon Board of Accountancy, and Section 5 deals with disclosure to the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners, also bullet 2 in the report. Section 6 of the bill is not related to the compliance report, but is a result of a very recent court decision, the Oregon Supreme Court decision, in which the court ruled that the language that's in the statute now, 305.437, requires that there actually be damages shown when a taxpayer makes a frivolous argument in the court. There's damages of up to $5,000 that can be assessed for a frivolous argument. A frivolous argument, for example, might be that the 16th Amendment to the Constitution was never adopted and therefore no one owes any income tax, or we're still on the gold standard, so they don't receive income because they don't receive gold. Yes. Those types of frivolous arguments, the court can impose up to $5,000, but it is damages. And the court interpreted that word to mean actual damages. So we're recommending that be changed to penalty, so it's clear that it is actually a punitive award and not related to actual damages that might be shown. On page 8 of the bill, section 8 relates to item B2 in the compliance report, and this is dealing with the data matching with financial institutions. The language in the bill itself is on line 13 and line 14 does say that the department and financial institutions shall enter into agreements to the maximum extent feasible. We suggest that you consider changing that to may enter into agreements. The intent of this is to piggyback on an existing system that exists with financial institutions and child support. And we're looking to just use that same system to do this data matching with financial institutions. And then also on lines 19 and 20, you'll see that same reference to a petition before the department, and that would need to be changed as well. At the bottom of page 8 of the bill, section 9 is the section that Representative Smith spoke about with the reporting to consumer reporting agencies. And I have not had an opportunity to talk with Representative Smith about this, but the language on 41 provides that the reports will be if the taxpayer has neglected or refused to file any return. My thought is that it probably needs to be deleted, because what we need to be reporting are delinquent taxes, not necessarily whether they have refused to file a return. So that probably would need to come out of that.
Right, because that has no real... It's a different thing than owing money for something.
Yes, Madam Chair. Finally, Section 6 of the bill, that again is the penalty provision, should have an applicability date, and we would recommend that it apply to pending and future appeals.
Section 6.
So that would simply need to be added to the bill. And the final point that we have is we've been asked by the Public Utility Commission whether the legislature would consider adding some disclosure authority related to the 911 tax, so that there could be exchange of information between that commission, the Public Utility Commission, and the Department of Revenue to ensure compliance with the 911 tax. So if the committee is willing to consider that, we could have some language for that as well.
That wouldn't pose any problem as far as you're concerned, as far as the Department of Revenue is concerned?
We've been working with them on the language, Madam Chair, and with our attorneys, and we think that would be fine.
Is there a lot of money involved there?
Madam Chair, the well, it's relative, but that was an issue that was raised by the Secretary of State in an audit as to the 911 tax and whether it's being collected as appropriately as it should be. So we think there could be some additional work done in that area.
Okay, sure. Bring it to us, and we'll take a look at it. Okay. Questions from the committee? That's a good thorough run through here. I don't think I have any questions either. It was helpful to, you know, tie it to the compliance report because you can see, you know, where everything fits in. Do you have, in terms of policy and implementation, do you have an opinion on the shall versus may issue on reporting it to credit agencies?
Madam Chair, I think it's, as a general rule, it's preferable to have may because it allows us to adapt to changing conditions. When it's a mandate, it can become a little more difficult, especially if resources are scarce and there are other things that have to be reprioritized. But my director may have a different opinion on that. I would defer
maybe
to her.
Maybe we can have a little fight here. Ms. Hartjenga, did you want to
comment? Madam Chair, I know not to fight with Deborah.
We all learned that, too.
Yes. On the shell versus May, I concur with her advice that authorizing us to use it allows us to do that in an intentional and planful way. If there's a mandate with an effective date and then we're scrambling and we discover there's a programming problem or some issue where we're not comfortable that information we would be reporting would be accurate, I would not want to be reporting something that we couldn't stand behind and say, this is the right tax, this is the right individual, this is the right amount, they are in fact delinquent, and this is in fact a liquidated amount. And there are certain requirements we know we will have to meet in order to be reporting, and there may be some costs also that we would have to incur. So I just want to make sure that we're ready to use the tool and to use it correctly and effectively. And the authorization would allow us to do that. The barrier has always been that we were concerned about our authority to disclose, not that we were concerned it wasn't an effective tool.
Okay. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you said that because, you know, as I read this, I'm real concerned about the taxpayers' rights. There's a lot of Big Brother stuff in mm-hmm. here that's, I mean, confidentiality, banks submitting to the department Social Security numbers of everybody has a bank account in a bank. Now that is, to me, is very far-reaching. The Department of Revenue is notified when there's earnings from those bank accounts in the form of, you know, the interest 1099s. But to just out there tell the Department of Revenue who's banking where and all their Social Security numbers and releasing some information here to other things makes me very, very uncomfortable. Very, very uncomfortable. I've been on the other side representing clients, and I've seen abuses. I've seen overstatements. I've seen overreaching. And so I'm very concerned at how far-reaching this is into the personal lives of Oregonians.
And Madam Chair, we have the same concerns. We would want to be very, very clear the purpose for which any disclosure would be made, the nature of the information, and the way that it would be protected. One of the reasons we wanted to try to take advantage of the child support agreement that's already in place is that it has those kinds of protections already built into it. And in order to do the matching, there may be a way to do some of that without having to resort to highly sensitive confidential information. I don't know enough yet about how their program works. But this is the balancing act that you as the policymakers and we as your tax administrator need to thoroughly explore. There's a benefit to making information available in terms of enabling us to do a better job and be more efficient at the work that you've given us to do. At the same time, there are risks. The more information that is used, especially through technology, and we want to be very, very sure that we don't either violate your expectations or taxpayers' reasonable expectations that are based upon the law that creates that confidentiality for tax information. So this is something that I trust, I believe, and I hope that you will explore thoroughly. What are those downside risks? How do you decide whether the risk is worth taking? And then if you decide that it is, what are the protections that we can put in place to minimize that risk to a reasonable level? And be very, very careful about using these kinds of tools, because it is certainly not our desire. And in fact, I can tell you the conversations in the agency often start with, we have an obligation to hold taxpayer information confidential. How do we begin to use new tools and still do that? So it's a conversation you definitely need to have.
Well, and also, I'm glad you brought this up, Senator Telfer, because we're going to be having a number of policy decisions in this area in this session and having nothing to do with revenue. But it all goes down to the same thing. Should you bring everybody into a disclosure situation so that you can catch the few mm-hmm. non-compliers? So one of the things that I'm very comfortable with is tying data matching, everything else, to people who either don't file a return or don't pay. I mean, if someone has a choice over, you know, what they're doing, they choose not to file a report, a tax return, or they choose not to pay their taxes when they're due, that's a different category than having some kind of broad-based, you know, disclosure of banks or whatever for all taxpayers and hope that you can catch the few who are trying to evade taxes.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, on the data matching, our understanding of that tool is that we would not be asking for information about all taxpayers, that the only accounts that we would be seeking information for would be liquidated debt that is delinquent, where we can then report the name of a debtor and their identifying information to be included in the match run.
And I don't think that's clear the way the bill is
then
now.
It does need to be made clear, because that our expectation was that this is another tool mm-hmm. to collect delinquent debt.
Right.
It's not a tool to create a huge database on all taxpayers.
Right. Senator Telfer.
Thank you. And in light of that, I would also want to make sure that refusing to pay a tax is a lot different than being in arrears and trying to work it out. And there are a lot of taxpayers that are trying to work with the department to pay their tax, but it's an outstanding debt. And I would hate to see them have to go through some of this while they're trying to work this out. Lots of times they go through an audit, they end up paying a tax that they were not intentionally trying to skirt the issue. And those amount to thousands and thousands of dollars. They can't come up with that. And so they're trying to work with the department, sometimes not successfully, because I've been on that side mm-hmm. representing clients, and they're trying to do their best, and it's going to take 5 years to pay that tax off. And I hate to have to see them have to go through all this because of something that they was not intentional. When you start adding up penalties and interest over 3 years, because that's how long some of these audits are taking, they'll never get out of the hole.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, when we come back with some amendments, it would be beneficial to us to have more conversation about what sorts of guidance the legislature wants to give to the agency about the use of these tools. More that you give us, the happier we are, quite candidly, because then we know that you've thought about the consequences to taxpayers and what the effects will be, and you've given us the direction that then we can confidently go forward and say this has been vetted and thought through carefully by the legislature, and you have had the opportunity to weigh the impact on individuals who find themselves owing tax for a variety of different reasons, anything from I'm reporting but I can't pay right now to I've had an audit and I now have a liability that's not planned for in my budget to I'm not going to pay you until you, you know, come and haul away my car. But, you know, we have the whole range, and our folks are trying to meet people where they are and work with them. What I think I heard, at least in the work group discussion with Representative Smith on the particular issue of the reporting to the credit agencies, was that as a lender, he would want to know whether someone had an outstanding obligation that might affect their creditworthiness, as much as he would want to have the Department of Revenue taking advantage of that sort of third set of eyes, looking at people and saying, gee, if you've got an obligation here, you need to be taking care of it. So we would very much welcome having those conversations about some of those very real personal human kinds of situations that if we have a one-size-fits-all set of directions, sometimes folks then get caught up in something that where it doesn't feel very good at all, and it doesn't look good.
And again, you know, part of this is just, I mean, if people understand perfectly well that if they don't pay their mortgage, they could have the most compelling story on earth, and that is still going to be reported to the credit bureau.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, the bank lost my check, and I still got reported to the credit bureau. It took me 2 years to straighten it out. So, you know, there's no tolerance in that situation, and I think paying your taxes is just as important as paying your mortgage. But then when you get to the different level, you know, with disclosure and banks and Social Security numbers, that gets to a different level of privacy. And I guess, I mean, I'd almost encourage you to take the Willie Sutton, you know, philosophy of go where the money is, you know, to prioritize in terms of use of these tools. But it would seem to me, you know, the more I reflect on it, that reporting to a credit bureau for delinquent taxes, it's not a punitive thing, it's a report. And it, mm-hmm. But it also might give you some tools from lenders who would, you know, actually in the consumer's interest, if they have this outstanding debt, would actually end up working on your behalf or on our behalf to get that money repaid.
Thank
but
you.
It's a difficult issue.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Would it satisfy Senator Telford's concerns if we excluded those taxpayers who had in fact executed a payment plan, a workout with the department, that they would not be reported?
Well, it would be a step in the right. It's sometimes very difficult and time consuming to work that plan out. I mean, it can take some time, depending on who your auditor is. I can tell you that, or who your collection person is. Some are very easy to work with, some not so much. So what happens in that interim when there's that tax owed that there's no plan on in the records that's been signed? So, yeah, I think that's a good conversation to continue to have and try to protect the privacy of good-intentioned taxpayers. I mean, that's going to help compliance
uh-huh.
versus this big brother strong hand coming down on them. I'm not sure it's up to us to help lending institutions with potential creditors or debtors, because you know they ask the question, what do you owe? And I just think it's becoming much more big brother than I feel comfortable with. But I can see that. But again, that it sounds simple, but when you actually start getting into working with the department when you owe tax, it can be a very lengthy process to come to that agreement if you ever get to that agreement.
But you know, to use the mortgage as an example, I mean, you don't, if you're working out a deal with your mortgage company to avoid foreclosure, you're still in that credit. You know, you're still reported to the credit reporting agency.
Yeah, but they're all getting bailed out. Well, that's
there's nobody bailing out the taxpayer that's trying to make their tax payment.
That's a different committee meeting.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
If I may reflect on page 6 of the compliance report, where it characterizes the type of income, high visibility, medium, and low visibility, and the lack of estimated compliance for those activities, you know, it's kind of astounding to think of business income with low visibility with a 57% compliance. That's a compliance rate or tax gap rate.
Misreporting.
That's misreporting. 57%. Farm income, 72%. Capital gain, 11.8%. Rents and royalties. I mean, those are pretty visible kinds of things. 51%. Mm-hmm. So while I very much appreciate Senator Telfer's concern about interweaving, you know, bank accounts with the Department of Revenue and a data exchange, on the other hand, if we have this amount of non-compliance, maybe there should be some type of ability to check. If, you know, I don't know how you would go about that, but those kinds of non-compliance rates kind of make me angry because I pay taxes.
Mm-hmm. But the question is, non-compliance for what reason? Is it because the tax code is so complicated and therefore? I haven't read the report yet, so I'm not sure what the context of this non-compliance is, because I can tell you as I read down those, there's some very difficult tax code ramifications here that would create a misunderstanding on how something was reported. That wasn't intentional non-compliance. It was, you know, try to weave yourself through the 3,000 code sections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Madam Chair, all of the points that are being made are extremely valid, and there are many different aspects and dimensions of either non-compliance or just lack of ability to comply that we tried to touch on in the report. And Senator Telfer has reminded us of one of the first ones, which is just simply the complexity of the code. Even if Oregon's tax code, our portion, was as simple as possible, we would still be building on an incredibly intricate and complicated federal code. I mean, that's the choice that that the legislature made decades ago, and that complexity creates its own impact on people's ability to understand what they're doing without expert professional guidance in some cases, and confusion. And we gave a couple of examples in the report of even in Oregon how lottery winnings are taxed is different from state to federal, and there's a lot of confusion. And then on the visibility issue, it's really more about third-party reporting of information. And but the misreporting percentage, as you may recall from the report, is the IRS did a study. They pulled 46,000 tax returns from across the country and attempted to, from those returns, develop some estimates of misreporting, whether it was intentional or unintentional, and then extrapolate that back to create a gap amount. How much tax money wasn't coming in tax year 2001 that probably should have come in, and then divided up among these categories. So there's a certain amount of assumption and estimation behind the numbers. But I think in terms of relative orders of magnitude, the point that that the IRS made and that we hoped was carried through in the table is that the more you have independent third-party information that verifies an amount of an income item or a deduction, the more likely it is that that's going to be reported and reported accurately. And as that visibility through third-party reporting drops away, and the calculation of liability is grounded in records that are kept only by the taxpayer in whatever way they've kept those records, that the risk of noncompliance, whether it's through complexity or lack of understanding or, gee, it's only a little bit and it won't matter, or it's I'm not going to get caught because the audit lottery is in my favor, you have that whole spectrum of reasons why people do or do not report fully or calculate fully what their liability is. So it orders of magnitude, I think, Senator Moore's more than exact precise numbers, and again, grounded in a sample from across the country that was done from 2001 tax returns. Our attempts to verify those overall conclusions with our own staff from their experience as in doing audits and with other states indicates that there's validity on the orders of magnitude. But once again, the discussion you're beginning to have is the one I hope that you do have, and that is to weigh what's the impact on privacy values, confidentiality of information people protect to themselves, future compliance. If the Department of Revenue is perceived as just stern enough, but not so big brother that people want to run and hide, that's a balancing act that we always have to maintain. And there are constantly moving parts and aspects and dimensions of all of this, just as there are, you know, the differences across human beings who file tax returns and pay taxes in the state. So I would ask whether on the data match it would be valuable to you to hear from child support how that system actually works, because that's the one we were envisioning piggybacking on. So that rather than me speculating about whether it's all obligors or only the obligors who are in arrears and exactly what information is given to the banks and exactly what information comes back, might help you as you decide whether you want to give us the tool, and if you do, whether you want to put any constraints on it.
That's actually a good suggestion. This is going to be a big priority for our committee, and I think that's a good suggestion. We will bring
okay, well, we'll work with your staff then to find people who are knowledgeable about how that system works.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else out there? The collectors. The collectors want to weigh in on this. Welcome, Mr. Marquis.
Madam Chair, thank you for the moment here. I wasn't going to testify, but Jim Marquis, on behalf of TransUnion, Credit Reporting Agency, and the Oregon Collectors Association, and I'll just be somewhat brief. In Section 9, you had the conversation about whether that should be shall or may. It needs to be may. There are three major credit reporting companies in this nation, TransUnion, Brand X, and Brand Y. And they enter into agreements with all sorts of creditors, and creditors report to them under those agreements that are mutually agreed to by the two parties involved in the contract. And part of those agreements is the manner in which items are reported and the format in which they're reported and all of those kinds of things. This legislature, while it is mighty and powerful, has the authority to mandate that any credit reporting agency accept information from the Department of Revenue. So you really need to use May and let them go forth and do good in terms of negotiating an agreement with one or more credit reporting agencies. And I do want to comment just to answer Senator Rosenbaum's questions about, does this really motivate folks, or are they motivated to pay because they're going to be reported to a credit agency? Probably not very often. How this really works is the consumer gets this reported to the credit reporting agency and goes down to buy some furniture or a car or some other item they want to buy, and this is on their credit report and they're refused credit as a result of it, and that motivates them. So there is a motivation, but it's kind of secondary and down the line. So Lastly, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, we had a very interesting conversation in my Government Relations Committee regarding Section 8, and two or three of my collection agencies said, can we get this right, too? We'd like to have all this information. I just want to say that I thought the conversation the committee had here today was thoughtful, and it was good to have that conversation. This is indeed a balance of privacy and the need to collect money on behalf of the state. And I think that you need to think beyond the provisions that are here. This particular program started as part of a project with collecting child support, and now the Department of Revenue says, let's use it for collecting taxes. And I'm kind of thinking back to the time when the Department of Revenue started a program called the Other Agencies Program, in which they collect money for other state agencies. And that was kind of a limited program, and then other agencies joined, and then we said let's make that available to counties in certain instances, and to there's always a bill every session to make somebody eligible to use the Department of Revenue for the collection of these debts, which is fine. But at once you institute this kind of a program, you're going to see other agencies coming in who are owed money that aren't necessarily taxes saying, me too, and why not? Because you've already done it for these guys. And then you're going to see the counties come, and then you're going to see the cities come, and, you know, and judicial and all the other folks for the traffic tickets and whatever it is. So think about that. I think it's an important issue, and, again, one of balance, and I think you need to be very thoughtful in pursuing this.
Thank you. On your, we are, we actually could build quite an empire here, I think, if we worked at it, but that's not
well,
what we're here for.
and beyond, Madam Chair, you need to ask hard questions about what happens to the data. I don't know exactly how this, I'm not even sure I know what an automated data exchange is. I think it's some kind of a private company that does this. So what do they do with the information? How's that stored? How's it protected? You know, all of those privacy issues. We spent a lot of time on identity theft here in this building. And
but I wanted to. I wanted to get back to your comment on Section 9, where you encouraged us very strongly to go may rather than shall. There really, if we decided that we really wanted to make this the norm, there would be nothing to stop us from, for example, saying the Department of Revenue shall enter into agreements with the credit reporting agency. In other words, recognizing that we can't order your client or
sure.
Y or Z to enter in a relationship, but still, if we want to be a little stronger, to mandate that they try to do that.
You could certainly order them to pursue it, and
right.
And I think that's perfectly fine. I just, if you say they shall report this stuff, you almost put them at a disadvantage in dealing with a credit reporting agency who now knows they have to report, so they might put requirements on them they might not otherwise put on them.
Higher rates, maybe? Oh, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there. Okay, other questions from the committee?
Thank you
very much.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody else who wants to talk on this? All right.
That
was a good discession today. We are adjourned.